So my presentation is not actually going to focus explicitly on health impact assessment itself, but kind of looking at how health impact assessment and at least its core concepts and principles can be applied in the local level and then putting it in the context of the limitations of a local health department. So I'm going to focus on, I guess, looking at social determinants using GIS and how health impact, how that can inform health impact assessments and vice versa. And for this particular presentation, I'm going to focus on food and liquor. Is there anybody in here from Chicago area? There's a really good album that came out about 4 or 5 years ago by a hip-hop artist named Lupe Fiasco, and he called it Food and Liquor. And I thought it was kind of brilliant. I don't know if it was intentional, but I think that in a lot of urban environments, that food and liquor kind of sums up the living conditions and built environmental conditions in a lot of these neighborhoods that affect health. And this picture's actually across the street from the health department, and I thought it was interesting that there's a sign that tells people not to go into the store, but they don't really have any option. So part of what I've been working with Equity Matters, the Baltimore Place Matters team, is on civic engagement for public health. And this is a letter that we got that was sent to me by Wanda, a community leader, and for me to forward on to our new health commissioner, basically asking for her support as they challenge these challenges in their own community. And I'm actually not a fan of reading, but I'm actually going to read this. This is something that she said to the commissioner asking for support. Our community sometimes seems under constant attack from an onslaught of unhealthy things. We fight them only to have them come back reincarnated a few months later. For instance, we just defeated someone trying to put a liquor store in a location less than 300 feet from an elementary school in its athletic field, which is illegal. Then 2 months later, another individual tried to put a fried chicken store in the same location. We are asking your support in fighting with us to prevent any future establishments such as these from trying to open in our community. She later goes on, we worked with her for a little while, gave her some data, some of this GIS mapping, social determinants, which Baltimore City for the first time is actually really getting into, and proactively sharing with community groups like this one here. So she later goes on to thank us for the information and other being shared about what other communities are doing. We know we are not crazy or alone in this struggle, and that other communities have not only faced the struggle nationally, but have found devised ways to fight it in a way that doesn't require constant vigilance and the stress of the companies. I'll come back to the constant vigilance part in a little bit, but for right now, I'm going to focus on fried chicken and liquor stores, these, of course, being kind of, you know, large umbrellas for food environment and building social environment. So first, the food. This is another picture across the street from the health department that I think really captures. I'm currently leading a couple youth photo boys projects in this neighborhood, and I think this picture right here really captures what we're talking about here. The health department is located in the food desert itself, and there's about 1,100 employees, 780 live in city limits, and of that 780, 50% of them live in food deserts. So the health department's in a food desert, and half the health department employees live in a food desert. So some of the social determinants data that we're trying to put out now and put in the hands of community groups so they can start to, so we can build a capacity and really have an inside-outside game. City agencies trying to take the lead, but also empowering residents to have the information to proactively go on the offensive for once. So many Baltimore residents live in communities with a lack of access to healthy foods and saturation places that sell unhealthy foods. This figure right here shows fast food density by community poverty levels in 2009. The axis on the far left, 25% of families in poverty. To the far right, less than 10% of families in poverty. You can see that there's about 5 fast food restaurants per 10,000 residents in high poverty communities compared to 1.4 in the low poverty communities. Same thing for carryout density. And carryouts in Baltimore basically can be summarized by fried chicken and lake trout, which actually isn't trout, it's more like whitefish and pollock, but don't tell people that in Baltimore. So for the carryouts, it's interesting. There's only about 120 fast food establishments in Baltimore City, but there's over 1,000 carryouts. And so I know nationally, a lot of the indicators of the built food environment have like ratios about fast food to supermarkets, but in Baltimore, it's kind of not so relevant. You can see there's about 21 carryout restaurants per 10,000 residents in the high poverty communities compared to just 6.5 in the low income or the low poverty communities. And here's a map just showing that the orange dots represent the fast food locations, and the shading of the purple represent the density of carryout density by neighborhood. You can see the east side and west side of Baltimore down the center where the dark spot is. That's downtown. That's where most of the fast food restaurants are, by the way. But east side, Baltimore, west side of Baltimore tend to be where the carryouts are most saturated. Of course, there's lots of literature on fast food and health, et cetera, so I won't go into that now. This is a similar figure to the other ones, except this shows corner stores, which includes like gas station mini marts and convenience stores as well. But again, you can see it in the high poverty communities, there's about 4 times as many corner stores as into the low poverty communities. There's a lot of Baltimore-specific research, actually, that shows that about 3/4 of these smaller stores don't regularly carry fruits and vegetables or carry dairy products. And also other Baltimore-specific research that shows that the stores that are in predominantly black and low-income neighborhoods, about 43% of them could be classified as having the least healthy food availability compared to just 4% in predominantly white communities. And this basically supports national research from other cities that shows that low-income and black and Latino communities tend to have less healthy food options. So here's a map of supermarkets, the orange and white dots you can see there, and then also the shading of the purple on this map represents the density of corner stores and little carryout, or not carryouts, but convenience stores. Again, the darker purple, the more dense the corner stores here. If I can just go back quickly, you can see that the same neighborhoods that have the most carryouts also have the most corner stores. So if you add this all up, it makes for a lot of not so healthy food options. And then you can see there's some pretty big gaps in between the east side of Baltimore and west side of Baltimore where there's no supermarket. And this is actually where I'm leading a couple of Photo Voice projects on food deserts in these two areas here that kind of get the perceptions of those who live in the community. So I'll go quickly onto the liquor portion now. No surprise again here. Far left, communities that have greater than 25% of families in poverty, there's about 10 liquor stores per 10,000 residents compared to about 3 in the low poverty communities. Implications for this are pretty pronounced and consistent in the public health research in terms of social cohesion, crime, et cetera, et cetera. Tobacco stores, again, similar story, about 4 times as many tobacco stores in high poverty communities compared to low poverty communities. And it's interesting, the neighborhood in Baltimore City that has the highest density of tobacco stores also has the highest mortality rate from lung cancer. I haven't really gone in to do any like analysis to control from confounders, and I really don't think it's really necessary. I think that we have enough information to kind of take this seriously, especially just looking at the disparity in the access. That's a social justice issue just in and of itself, I think. Vacant buildings. Of course, in the literature, there's a lot of research out there that shows the link between the presence of vacant buildings in the neighborhood and opportunity for physical activity, crime, safety, fire-related injuries, et cetera. No surprise here, Baltimore City, I think 20% of all the units in Baltimore City are vacant right now. And so, again, in the high poverty communities, you see there's about 1,500 vacant buildings for every 10,000 units, compared to just 36 in the low poverty communities, which is about a 40-some-fold difference. Not a natural thing going on here. Vacant lot density is a similar story. The magnitude is not as great, but again, there's a big disparity there. This actually presents itself from my perspective, more of an opportunity. There's a lot of vacant lots there. There's a lot of things you can do with them, especially from a public health perspective. They could be zoned for, put aside for a supermarket. They could be zoned for parks and recreational space, zoned for urban agriculture, community gardens, et cetera. So a lot of opportunity with this one, at least. So this is a composite of the community built social environment. The shading on this map in the blues is the density of vacant buildings by neighborhood. The green is the green space and park space. The pink dots that just popped up are the liquor stores. This is just the store licenses, not the taverns and bars, just the takeaway package stores. You can see there's a pretty good overlap between where the vacant buildings are and where the liquor stores are. Those are the homicide locations just from the year 2009. Again, you can see that the homicide locations are pretty well correlated with where the built social environment indicators would predict that these homicides would occur. And those blue boxes that just popped up are the recreation centers. There are literally recreation centers on the same block as liquor stores where just the week before someone was shot and killed. So in the context of public health practice and like something like childhood obesity, and we're telling people to get physical activity, and they have neighborhood blight and liquor stores, and then people getting shot down the block from the recreation center, certainly has implications for what we can really achieve. So all that in a nutshell, I really only showed all these maps just to articulate that doing a lot of GIS on focusing on social determinants, not so much on the health outcomes. I could have put up the homicide mortality rates, the heart disease mortality rates, lung cancer, et cetera, but they would have been in the same neighborhoods where these things would predict that they would be. So the point of all this is really just to show that there's all these things in the same neighborhood. And as the woman, as Wanda was saying in her letter, it's like every other month they have to go on a new battle. They're never on the offensive, they're always on the defensive. And so she's dealing with fried chicken and liquor stores, but what she's really talking about here is she's dealing with basically everything in an urban environment that could potentially pose a threat to health. And so the point I want to get back to is that she's wondering if there's a way that we can go about doing this that does not require the constant vigilance. And I think that's where health impact assessment is critically important. One of the things that I wanted to talk about here is that in Baltimore City, you know, local health departments' budgets are low, so doing health impact assessments all the time is really not a feasible or practical thing. Perhaps identifying a subset of policies that would really merit a full-out formal process would be something that would be useful. And just to kind of illustrate this point, in 2008, all Baltimore City Council policy showed that 85% of all policies with the potential to impact health were not reviewed for health concerns, including those related to land use decisions affecting the location and distribution of liquor stores and food choices. So all these things that Wanda's concerned about, there's actually policies that could be affecting how these things are allocated, and they're not being forwarded to the health department for review of potential health impacts. And this is actually a breakdown of those policies. On the left bar, you have resolutions, which don't carry a lot of weight. They're usually pretty soft and not so much being, they're just kind of like, oh, it's Asthma Awareness Month, let's celebrate it, those types of things. Which they're important, but you know, like, it's not like the council member's going to get up there and do something about traffic congestion or anything like that or improve housing quality. It's just like, let's celebrate it. And so of the 93 resolutions, 39 of them were identified as having potential health impacts. Of the 245 ordinances, which are the more the where the weight's at with the laws, 107 were identified as having potential health impacts. So it's a total of 146 policies that could potentially affect health directly, indirectly, in some manner. Of those 146 policies, 49 were explicitly related to health, meaning that the policy itself said something that was related to health, something about teenage pregnancy or asthma or crime or safety. Of those 49 policies, just 15 were actually forwarded to the health department for review and comment. Now the assumption is here, I'm using this as an indicator of whether it was reviewed for health, but somebody's, for example, with crime, they would be forwarded to the police department or the fire department, so they might be actually being kind of reviewed. But only 15% referred to the health department. For the policies related to health determinants, so the social determinants related policies, things like zoning, land use, vacant buildings, education, transportation policy, et cetera, just 9 of those 97 were forwarded to the health department. So we're really missing out on the ones that are really driving the living conditions of Baltimore City residents. One current policy, I think, that is started in 2007. The policy is not introduced yet. It's planning to be introduced probably next winter, probably the fall of 2011. Is a zoning code rewrite, Transform Baltimore effort, which actually the colleagues from Human Impact Partners are really taking that on as to do a health impact assessment of that, and it's been completed. So this is an example of a policy here that actually all the things that Wanda's concerned about, this policy right here actually has the ability to do something about that. And the health impact assessment that was done on this actually identified improving the food environment and trying to mitigate the effects of concentration of liquor stores on community health. So there's a really critical policy right here. But as Aaron pointed out earlier, some of the concerns with doing health impact assessments is that they're not really, there's no real guarantee that these recommendations will be adhered to. And one of the things we're running into, I'm on a public health working group, which some of the members that are on that were involved with this as well, that is kind of reviewing the code and trying to put forth recommendations. Something that we're running into is that the planning department and other city agencies are actually pretty intimidated by the power of the liquor board and the liquor lobby. And so it's one of those things where it's like a fine line of like, do we want the policy passed? How much do we want to rock the boat on some of these issues? And so I think this is what, you know, it's a good example of what health impact assessment can do, but I think that we're not really trying to get this what I call inside-outside game going on, where we're putting resources and information in the community residents' hands and having them get increased capacity to make the same demands that we would like to see as public health experts. There's no guarantee that some of these recommendations will be actually acknowledged. So back quickly to the policy review in 2008, I actually had conversations with the mayor when she was city council president and her staff about how we might be able to move forward on this. I shared the results with her, she was concerned. And some of the recommendations they put forth were, one, to have a city council training and briefing, so basically identify maybe 3 or 4 champions in City Hall who would basically take this on and be the experts, be the voice. So if there's a policy that was in there, they would be the ones that were basically briefed to maybe call more attention to the health impacts. They also suggested drafting a health/equity guidance document for the staff, something that similar to what Martin Luther King Jr. County in Seattle has put together, the Equity Impact Assessment Tool. Have you guys heard of that? A few people. So we started to develop something similar like that. That kind of got derailed because we had a mayor kicked out of office for corruption, and then the city council president became the mayor, and the politics changed a little bit. But all these things were definitely recommended, so we're hoping to have these conversations actually continue. One of the other recommendations was perhaps a city council resolution or informational hearing. that would basically allow people to come together and just get the conversation started, which I think is very one of the most more critical things we can do is just get the conversation going, to have planning here, to have education, to have housing all in the same room, potentially to have a conversation. And the last one was to try to increase monitoring of the policy, and that could be either proactively the health department trying to ask for more policies or some process where policies would be identified and sent to the health department for review. And the idea of creating an equity impact kind of committee that would be charged with kind of overseeing some of these developments. So anyway, key takeaway points. I hope I was somewhat coherent in this. I tried to fuse so many things together just to stay on topic with this session. Basically, there's a need to increase focus on underlying determinants of health, that's focused on policies and systems that drive the conditions that determine health. And health impact assessment, of course, is marvelous. We all love it. But I think the local level public health practice is not something that can be done in its full formal process for all 122 policies, for example, that we missed in Baltimore. And so I think that finding a way to identify the ones that really deserve this, and then also finding out a way that the ones that aren't so large that maybe don't require a full process could still be reviewed for potential health impacts. And I think part of what I'm learning in Baltimore City is that this really requires having people on the inside working with the policy people, people at the table from planning, different other city agencies that their purview constitutes a social determinant of health, but then also using the data that we have to kind of put that into the community's hands, train them, build capacity so that we have a bit of pressure from the outside. So when the people inside lack the political will and are kind of caught up in some of the political decisions that go into the work, that there's still somebody advocating out there. And I think that this is something that, in terms of public health practice, you have to really work better for, that turns some of this anecdotal evidence into just evidence. And that is really meaningful. And I think that would get us closer to participatory public health practice. And then maybe in the end, everything will be fantastic. And that's it. No disclosures.
So one of the benefits of only having four presenters on our panel is that we actually have about 20 minutes for questions, which I think is really great. And so I'm going to invite everybody up here. Excuse me. And I think, yeah, so I'm going to start over here, woman with the yellow vest.
Hi, I work in Philadelphia, and health impact assessment is new to me. And I'm wondering if there's any movement towards getting it into public health
So the question was on getting HIA into public health or urban planning schools. Who would like to? Aaron?
Here. So currently there are two schools that I know of in the U.S. that offer courses on health impact assessment. That's UC Berkeley and University of Wisconsin at Madison. The UW-Madison program is really focused on global environmental change, not so much the urban planning issues that you heard a lot about today. And so I think there's a huge need. There is a lot of interest. There's been a lot of curriculum development independent of schools of public health. And I think that it wouldn't be hard for schools to start curricula start offering courses in HIA. NACHO and APA, the American Planning Association, put together a curriculum on HIA, again, not as part of a grad school curriculum, but actually for practitioners who wanted to do an online course. So that's also available. But I think there's a huge need.
Two questions. First for Angelo and Marnie. Where was the local public health agency in the work that you were engaged in? You came from the community-based organizations, but I just wondered about local public health involvement. And then, Ryan, what resources actually exist within local public health in Baltimore to address, should they be successful in getting what they're asking for, to review more? Do they have the resources to actually do that? Many of us around the country are facing cuts, not growth.
You guys, do you feel comfortable answering from there? Okay, so Angelo, do you want to go first? Then maybe, yeah, that's a great idea. Eek. Okay.
It's a lot of shuffling.
So for the 710 expansion project, because it's such a large span, there's a couple of different public health agencies. So LA County Department of Public Health was actually really involved and engaged in the discussion and dialogue around HIAs and has participated in the preliminary scoping of HIA and then helped to advocate for HIA to be included into the environmental review. The city of Long Beach has a department, a health department, but because both agencies are kind of under the government, agencies are government bodies, it's pretty political. So the local governments basically gave directives to both agencies to be kind of quiet on the issue. So Long Beach actually was kind of just hands off on the whole thing and said, you know, we don't even want to get involved. It's a policy question. It has nothing to do with health as far as we're concerned. So there's still that type of political issue related to the health agencies as well.
For the two projects that I talked about, one for the South LA redevelopment, that was the LA County Department of Public Health, and they were involved. They provided data and reviewed various products of the HIA, so the scope and the final report. And then in Pittsburgh, the Contra Costa County Department of Public Health actually contributed data too. That's a pretty common role for health departments to play in some of the types of relationships that we'll set up to do some of these HIAs.
So there's not a lot of resources at the Baltimore Health Department anyway. As of right now, I think I'm the only epidemiologist that's in office of epi and planning right now. And also we don't have a community health section. So there's not really community organizers or anything that are hired full-time staff. We actually don't even have a health policy analyst position. We have a health policy liaison who really just oversees kind of coordinating with City Hall on policy matters. But in terms of actually having, you know, four or five people to stay on top of this, review them, comment on them, we don't actually have that. And actually the results I presented here with the policy review, it took me about 80 hours of total time doing the review. And so I think having that in context, there's not, it's one of those things where, you know, if there was grants that were capacity building type grants to kind of get HIA into local public health practice, I think that'd go a long way into making this more. I think that might be one of the reasons why local health departments aren't really on a proactive end pushing it. It's usually nonprofits and research universities because the local public health departments don't have the resources to make this a part of what they do on a regular basis.
I think Aaron actually has a response also, and then I'm going to come over here for a question.
This is just two quick points to make about the resources question, because it's obviously huge. Asking health departments facing cuts to take on a new chunk of work that faces huge barriers and creates problems. I think there are two observations to make about current practice. One is that I think there are opportunities to fund a lot of this work that some health departments are starting to figure out. So the state of Alaska is funding a lot of its HIA work now. They have a new HIA program in the state health department, which will ultimately be funded largely by permit fees. And that's the way that environmental regulatory agencies and planning departments fund their work. San Francisco Department of Public Health, if I'm not mistaken, I think gets paid for a lot of the HIA work that it does as well, as part of, because it's now contributing sort of, you know, formal requested information to a planning process. So there actually are ways to pay for some of this, and other agencies are used to being paid for it. The second point is just really culture change in public health. I think that some health departments are beginning to really look at repurposing staff and developing more of a health in all policies programming approach rather than a sort of a traditional public health programs approach where you've got to staff WIC, you've got to staff the immunization program and restaurant inspections, et cetera, and really looking at, is there a way to repurpose it, you know, a little bit of the resources and begin having a broader reach.
Thank you.
I'm interested in these questions because I'm with the Indianapolis Marion County Health Department in the Epidemiology Division. We've worked in partnership to create a Health by Design Coalition, which now has 200 organizational members. And we've introduced not only complete streets, a resolution in our county council. Hasn't gotten all that far yet. But I just wanted to comment on the training issue as well as the staffing capacity within a health department. No, most health, we have 10 epidemiologists. I'm the chronic disease one. So no, none of us are going to have the staffing capacity within house. But we have designed an HIA training course with our local university public health program with an emerging doctorate in epidemiology, which will be offered this spring. And the project the students are going to work on is looking at the IndyConnect MPO transit plan.
Great.
We're shaking in our boots because it's going to be, you know, more than we probably need to bite off. But the question I'd like to bring is, I understand that EPA, HUD, and CDC have now been writing collaborative RFAs trying to address a number of environmental and sustainability issues across health and environmental health. Can you point us in the direction of where some of the local health departments maybe might be able to collaborate with some of their city partners and maybe looking at some of those funds towards getting some HIA infrastructure underway?
Okay. Erin, do you want to, or Ryan, I mean either of you guys? Great. So, and I'm going to ask people to keep their questions short, and then we'll try and keep the responses on point, too.
I could try the answer from Baltimore's perspective, but others definitely. I know in Baltimore, I mean, with the HUD, the retooling for HUD strategy, which basically has social justice equity all through it, the choice, promise neighborhood things, challenge grants and everything, those are all multi-agency collaborative grants. In Baltimore City right now, I cannot say with confidence that we have the collaboration that we need to be competitive for these grants. I'd say that with the recent efforts over the last two or three years that the health department and planning department have been working more collaboratively together, but there's not an established agenda, timeline, or framework. And so when these grants are coming on, you can possibly get like $4 million, $2 million to do these things, really addressing all these social determinants and these living built environment condition things with one grant and strategically. We don't have the structure, the formality right now to really be competitive for a lot of these grants. And so I think that that's something that, you know, increased capacity at the local level to actually have this a part of everyday practice, the culture shift, so that people are hired with the intent to actually do this work at the local level. Instead of like there's a grant coming out, now you got to scramble to find out who might be a relevant partner. I think that if we can make this a regular part of our practice, that's how we can really make ourselves competitive for getting some of these grants at the local level.
Very quickly, I think I totally agree with what Ryan said, and I think the Sustainable Communities Partnership is very significant. It's issued, I think, over $1 billion of funding so far, and to the chagrin of public health people, didn't include CDC or another health agency as part of the partnership, nor really health as an explicit focus, even though I think everyone recognizes that it is about community revitalization and well-being and ultimately health. And I think that is, it's an excellent target to be looking in communities where that are putting together funding proposals to be trying to get the health departments on board. And I doubt that there's going to be a lot of pushback if communities try to weave in health indicators and health objectives into proposals for those agencies.
There's a lot of hands up. I'm going to go back here to the gentleman with the tie.
I want to thank the speakers for a very good presentation. I've been watching the HIA movement for about 20 years now. Gratifying to see. It seems to me that there's two advances with HIA. I think we've done the first. The first advance with HIA is to help people understand the connection between policies outside the health sector and health outcomes. And the examples you've shown are good notions of that. But in some of these presentations, for example, the 710 freeway or the presentation from Baltimore, it's clear that there are market forces behind those decisions. So, you know, the container ships coming into Long Beach Harbor and so forth, there are economic reasons why they want that freeway expansion. Mm-hmm. And there are market forces that put those liquor stores in low-income neighborhoods. Beyond HIA is making the case that there's a health outcome from these policies. Since we're trying to reach an audience that cares about other things, like market forces, profits, tax revenues, is there some effort being made to reframe and repackage the outcomes of those HIAs in their language? So for every dollar that Long Beach gets from the influx of cargo ships, you're spending $5 in cardiovascular so that people begin to think in business terms.
So I think that's a great question. I will just say, having worked on HIAs for the past 8 years, that it is something we struggle with for every single HIA we do and really want to do and are only getting better and better at. And some really concrete examples of ways that we've dealt with that are things like hospitalizations, because there are cost estimates that are out there. And it's really challenging. And I'm going to let other folks on the panel answer that, but I do want to say that I think everyone in this movement is very well aware of what you're talking about and wants to do that to some extent, but not at the same time by sacrificing some of the, I think, values and principles that are underlying the process of doing HIA, which is trying to, you know, advance a social determinants, I think, prevention framework. Angelo, do you want to say something?
So, you know, the real push behind the expansion of the 710 freeway is the cargo throughput at the ports, and the region is really pushing to be continue to be the largest port complex in the nation, and they see that as the opportunity for upward mobility, in that there's a lack of educational attainment in the region and that there's some opportunity for wealth. But I think that you're right that they've excluded the health part of it, and our message is really that there is that health is wealth, and that if we weigh those things on balance in terms of what the impacts are versus, you know, or just weigh in between the impact, the negative impacts and the positive impacts, that gives us more information, and that the region can determine the outcome or the future for themselves versus responding to an influx of throughput. And so part of what we've asked for in the analysis is, or the assessment, is to really look at the economic impacts. You know, is this a real economic opportunity that goes across, you know, the whole region or the corridor, or is this only for an isolated population? And that's going to help to inform the decision makers that represent those communities that aren't necessarily going to get those good jobs.
It's a fundamental issue, and I think there's this field of cost benefit analysis. Very few HIAs have really taken advantage of the methodologies and experts in that field to try to do some intertwining. I think there's a desire to keep it, you know, to really make sure that we focus on health as an independent value, but at the same time the argument you make is right on, and I think fundamentally a lot of the issues we're dealing with are externalities. They're the health costs of decisions that are externalized on the public through healthcare expenditures, et cetera, that aren't recognized, aren't accounted for in the way that we value transportation systems, in the way that we look at subsidies for food and agriculture, et cetera. And so if we're able to do a better job in HIA of uncovering the externalities and the actual real costs associated, then I think it does offer an opportunity to make a much more powerful argument.
So anybody in the back? Yep. The gray sweater. Yep, Paula.
So I was having a vision of public health, and we actually have a grant right now to build the capacity of local health departments to do HIA, and we're really struggling because much of our public health workforce is not traditionally trained in public health, let alone having an HIA course. And I did leave the HIA course at UW Madison, and we're really struggling at how to get local practitioners on board with doing something that looks so rigorous and academic focused. We show them examples of 100-page HIA reports and asking them to take their precious time to do this. We're having a really hard time getting that buy-in and also understanding what the end goal of an HIA should be. How do we measure that success when reports look so different and the goals are so different? So getting that buy-in has been really challenging, and once we have that buy-in, getting them to that end stage of having a completed HIA and how they should measure success to report to their stakeholders has also been a challenge. So, if you can talk about how any strategies or ideas that you might have in that regard.
So this is this will be the last question. I should have said that. But we'll be here for a few minutes if people want to respond. And just to say, Paula's question is coming from a health department that's actually been like at the forefront of trying to institutionalize HIA. They've done a training for state agencies on HIA. They've done trainings for county health departments on HIA. They're funding HIA mini grants to counties around the state of Wisconsin. They're providing technical. So here you have, there's still a struggle, and yet they're doing so much. And so just to, I think, highlight what Wisconsin has done and give them props, I think, for that. Does anybody want to just kind of respond to the strategy? I mean, honestly, I'll respond to that question. So, I mean, the challenges are never ending. There will never be a point where you're like, we've reached the zenith, and there's no problems. And what I can say is that having worked at a health department for 7 years doing HIA, there are a few elements to the success. And I think this speaks to a question that we heard up front. A, like having a champion decision maker within your agency that essentially will go to bat for doing things like HIA or health and all policies or advancing health equity is kind of key. And having that champion decision, and it's not just one decision maker, but sort of having, I think, that buy-in then empowers staff to try and do things new and kind of out of the box. So I would say that's one strategy. I think another strategy is this idea of building collaborations with people and not saying we're doing a 100-page HIA first, but maybe we're going to write a comment letter on a project first. Or the first thing we might do is do like a mini indicators analysis and share the results in a decision-making context. So starting small, where you're kind of building the foundation of all the elements that go into an HIA, can be, I think, another strategy for how you build capacity and build buy-in with counties that are, you know, a little bit afraid of adopting this. And then I'll say, Aaron hit on this when he talked a little bit about the San Francisco Department of Public Health. I mean, being really creative with the resources that you have, and I think Wisconsin has done a good job with this, you know, allowing people to sort of spend some of their time working on projects that are outside of what their job description is, even if it's a few hours a week, I think also can be a strategy for getting people more comfortable with this. And doing projects internally that aren't going to be published, you know, outside initially can also, I think, build confidence in the practice. So those are really small, I think, administrative ways that you can try and create some comfort within the agencies. I don't know if anybody has anything else to add really quickly.
Also just sort of like relying on getting input from others throughout each step of the process. So, you know, scoping is a really great opportunity to start getting people engaged and help, you know, helping to draw out what, you know, we use like pathway diagrams that really like detail each step of the causal chain or potential causal chain that you might take, and people really, that allows them to sort of conceptually understand exactly what it is you're trying to do, and then they have some commitment to the project and want to help with data sharing and maybe executing parts of the assessment. So, you know, concrete ways of getting people involved too is really helpful.
So one thing I just want to say about this panel that I personally think is awesome is that we had representation from different levels of practitioners in HIA, sort of from a national leader to local leaders to technical assistance providers, and I think that that kind of represents sort of the breadth of opportunities in HIA, the partners that you can bring to the table, and the fact that you know, a lot of sessions at APHA that I've been to are often presenting research, and Marnie and I talk about this all the time, that where is the opportunity for the application of that research? Where can you actually take the work that you're doing and insert it to actually make change in some decision-making process? And what we tried to do with this panel was kind of highlight the different ways that you can actually apply research that you might be working on that's community relevant, that's driven by the community, that's participatory, and addresses a really wide range of issues, not just sort of one topic area that affects health. So I hope we were successful in doing that. I thank all of you for staying till the end. And thanks to our panel for doing a great job.